I will just very quickly go through some slides to talk about post-Marxism, post-modernism. It's more, maybe this lecture is more journalism than academic. I just very quickly want to say what's happened rather than getting too much into the detail of the arguments. And then after that, maybe this will take 20 minutes. After that, we will see a film, a documentary, and I will explain more about that film in a moment. I'm really picking up on where Andrew finished this morning, or some of the areas that Andrew talked about this morning, about what happened in the last 30 years regarding the image or the ideas of Marxism. And not just Marxism, but the whole idea of socialism, of social equality, of those sorts of questions. I started with Lyotard, a French philosopher, many of these French philosophers here, Lyotard, who wrote the book The Condition of Postmodernity in 1978, very famous book, and he did not invent the word postmodernity, but he made it famous. When this book came out, everybody said, oh, it's postmodern. And he claimed, in a way, he claimed it was the end of history, but not in the same way as Fukuyama said the end of history. We discussed Fukuyama yesterday a bit. He said there's no more revolution because we live in capitalist democracies, and that's the end, the perfect system. But Lyotard says something different. He says history has ended because we have no more big stories to tell. He calls it the end of the great narratives, the end of the big stories. And those big stories are Marxism, revolution, but also progress and science. So it's not just Marxism, but the whole idea of modernity, of development, of progress, of enlightenment, of the growth of truth, whether that's by capitalism or whether it's by Marxism or socialism, doesn't matter. We no longer believe in these big stories. And instead of these great narratives, we have games, what Lyotard called language games. We all construct our own meaning. We talk a language with each other, and we all understand the terms, and we can discuss within that language. But if people don't know our rules, if people are not with us in this conversation, then what we say is meaningless to them. And it's an idea he took from a philosopher, Wittgenstein, but he turned it into something very different, that now we've only got language games. We've only got meanings that exist between us in this room, but maybe elsewhere there's very different meanings. There's very different ideas of truth. And it really changed the atmosphere of discussion. At the same time, since the 1960s, people say that one of the 20th century's greatest philosopher, Jacques Derrida, had also begun a much more systematic destruction of Western philosophy. And he based many of his ideas on the work of the German philosopher Heidegger, at the bottom there, Heidegger, who had seen, who himself had followed Friedrich Nietzsche, the other German philosopher, in saying that since the ancient Greeks, for 2,000 years, we have been following reason, looking for reason and enlightenment, but in fact, this is an illusion. This is a dream of Western civilization, but in fact, it's resulted in failure. And Derrida tries to show how what he calls metaphysics, this idea constructing an objective truth, constructing the world as a rational entity that we can understand, it's an illusion. And Derrida does it extremely well, and extremely at a high sophisticated level. He's not very sophisticated. We cannot provide laws for the world, laws of reason, laws of truth, laws of anything for the world. And he says being, existence, the world always goes beyond language, goes beyond what we know of it. So we've got a real attack on Western enlightenment and perhaps Western civilization. At the same time, the idea of Marxism, and this is in the late 1970s and certainly in the 1980s, Marxism became under attack from many directions as a philosophy. And it's interesting because we say, oh, Marxism is materialism. You know, it's about economics, it's about the working class, it's about social justice. But in fact, everybody is a materialist now. Frederick Jameson, a writer who I will speak about later, asks, who is an idealist? Who really believes in idealism now? And certainly in Western philosophy, certainly in Western philosophy, everybody is a materialist. And so maybe it's Marx who has become the materialist. The idealist. Maybe it's Marxism that's really an idealism. So people began to show his links to Hegel, the German philosopher who believed that reason worked through history and we would reach the end of history. It's Fukuyama's use of his. That somehow history had a meaning, progress had a meaning, that however it happened, maybe very difficult, maybe much suffering and blood and war, but history was moving towards some sense of progress or revelation. And this was seen to be pure idealism. And the idea of Marx is really some sort of Christian, Judeo-Christian theology, that really he's talking about the Messiah, that at the end of history God will come and save us all. Other people see him as an aesthetic revolutionary. That really, although he talks about economics and revolution and the working class, he thinks somewhere at the end of history we will live in this perfect world where we will go, we will work in the morning, go fishing, play in the afternoon, and read philosophy at night. We will all live in some harmonious society. People say this is idealism, this is an illusion. So Marxism as a philosophy really sustained a lot of attack at this time. In a different area, Marxism as a politics also became highly criticised. First of all, and I spoke a bit about this yesterday, the idea of class struggle, that there are two classes and they will fight, and this is the main way in which history moves and the main basis of political analysis. This gives way to multiple points of identity and struggle. We cannot reduce politics to just the working class. There are many different interests, and this makes things gender, the women's movement, ethnic minorities, questions of racism, questions of sexual identity, a whole range of questions that cannot be reduced to one big struggle. That's well known, I think. Secondly, the economic base no longer determines politics. The economy is not the basis of everything. That we now deal with questions of ideology, questions of culture, questions of what people call hegemony, Gramsci, the Marxist politician, called it hegemony. But now, it's almost the realm of culture and ideology is more important than economics. Because you cannot look at the economic base and find out what's going to happen politically. And politics, is, especially after 1989, politics becomes about alliances, provisional alliances. So we can ally with you one day, but tomorrow we might ally with somebody else, join with somebody else. Because democracy, it's now about democracy. Not the Leninist party or the leading role of the working class, but about dialogue and discussion among a range of different interests. That's the only way we can go forward. It doesn't mean parliamentary democracy, but it does mean there cannot be a Leninist party. And finally, there's no revolution. No single act of transformation will change the world. It's going to be a series of small transformations, ongoing reform that way. And this really changed these ideas, and that are very much simplified. These ideas transformed left-wing politics in Europe and elsewhere. And within five years, the communist parties of Europe, in Italy, in France, had changed their names got reduced to absolutely small minority parties. And it was a sense that the whole Marxist workers' movement had disappeared overnight. And I think Andrew talked about that a bit this morning as well. Back to the philosophers. A very famous philosopher, or maybe we could call him a historian as well, Michel Foucault. Very, very important figure at this period, wrote in the 1960s and the 1970s, and he died, I think it was 84, 85, of AIDS, very famously in his book, Words and Things, that was written in 1966, and I quoted from it on Monday, when I talked about medieval, old knowledge. He says at the end of his first chapter, he says, after modernity, the human subject will disappear. He says, for two centuries, we've been living in the era of humanism, where man is at the centre of history. He says, that's about to change. And he has a famous sentence where he says something like the face of man will be washed away like a picture on the sand when the sea comes in. Sea will come in and will wash man away. So we know that the idea of the great Renaissance human subject is about to go. Foucault doesn't say what's going to come next, but what we've got is going to go. So very, very powerful in it. Attack on the idea of enlightenment and the subject. At the same time, he also begins to question the idea of human historical progress. Because, of course, Marx, many other people, but Marx saw capitalism as progressive. It did very bad things. It also brought great suffering, great destruction. But it was part of progress. And we must go beyond it, etc. But for Foucault, actually, historical progress is just another form of power, a reconfiguration of power. And he's one of his most famous works was about prisons. It's called Discipline and Punish. And he starts off that book by two stories. The first story is about a man who tried to kill the King of France in the 18th century, tried to kill Louis XV, and he didn't, and he was caught, and they killed him, they executed him, and they executed him in a really horrible way that everybody has to read. They chop his arms off, they do all bad things to him, and Foucault just tells the story. And then the next story is one day in the life of a prisoner in a modern prison. So 7 o'clock, wake up, 7:05, get dressed, you know, every minute of every day. And what he's doing is showing how we always think, oh, execution, torture is bad, uncivilized, barbaric, and modern prisons are civilized. But he's what he's trying to say is, what's the difference, but is one worse than the other? Actually, they're both forms of power in different ways. So he begins to talk about power, about of surveillance, of modern power, about constantly controlling the population, constantly regulating the population. And this isn't this isn't the power of the king. Foucault says we can't chop the king's head off. In the old days, if you wanted a revolution, you killed the king, chop the head off. What he also means is you get rid of the state, the capitalist state, the whatever. But we can't do that anymore, because politics now is in everyday life. It's at the personal relationship. It's at the micro level. So the idea of a revolution is very problematic. And finally, what Foucault begins to say, and this is more in the 1970s, is that power isn't just repressive. You know, the idea that we're all free and power squashes us down. But he says actually power produces things. Power is productive. It creates new things. And this really also transforms the political scene. It relates very much to another French philosopher. I think this is the last one for today. Deleuze, who I would say now is the most influential of those philosophers, which is rather strange because his works were extremely strange and marginal when they were first written. And his first book with his collaborator, Schizophrenia and Capitalism. And he tries to show how actually the schizophrenic, which is a mental disease, you know, it's where a schizophrenic is not one person, he's many different people. But it's this person with a mental illness, really, or he wouldn't call it an illness, but a person with a mental illness where he's not one person becomes an image of liberation, an image of freedom, whereas capitalism makes us into one person, tries to always restrict us and control us. And so it becomes almost, the problem with capitalism is not so much social inequality, but the way in which it controls our very mind, controls our subjectivity. And what I was saying yesterday about the aesthetic critique of capitalism, this is very much that, but now nothing to do with art particularly. It's actually about schizophrenia, it's about the people on the edges of the world. So he has many different ideas. I'll be quicker than this. For instance, he talks about that civilization versus the nomads. So you think of it, I mean, China is a classic example. China is the agricultural country with bureaucracy and a state and education. And outside somewhere are these wild Mongolians who come every now and then and kill people and go away. And actually Deleuze sees these wild nomads as the essence of freedom and humanity. Freedom and emancipation. And he's very much attracted by Nietzsche and the idea of vitalism, the idea that power is productive, that life is all about producing, it's endlessly productive, and that this we should listen to desire, listen to the productivity of desire and power as a way of living in this world, not follow the dictates of ethics and reason. These are very strong philosophies, and as I say, he's probably the most influential writer in a certain kind of cultural studies at the moment. And from that, and again this is Deleuze, but there are many people now who write books following them, they say, there's no such thing as totality. You can't see the system as a whole. So it's a concept that Hegel had, but also Marx. To use the word capitalism means that there's a system called capitalism. But they're saying there's no such thing as this total system. And Deleuze would talk about an assemblage, that in fact it's not a system, it's actually lots of different organs, lots of different aspects put together, assembled. They're not really a coherent system. They work together, but they can easily separate out and become something else. So he very famously says, there's no such thing as totality. There's just additions. It's like one of those kids' toys, you know, where you just put another thing on, and put another thing on, and another thing, and another thing. And he says, and. It's not a totality. So it's very much against the idea, Marxist approach, that somehow we can understand the connections between the system as a whole. And it is, I think it is a radical critique of capitalism as what he calls a territorialization of desire. The way in which desire, remember my definition of aesthetics, what is it that we like? What's attractive to us? So how is that desire made part of the system of capitalism? So, and it's a very radical way of addressing that. And he says that somehow desire always goes beyond capitalism. It always evades it. It always somehow reinvents itself in another way. Deleuze was writing in, well, these ideas in the 1970s. Now, people use Deleuze to describe capitalism. They use Deleuze to describe how capitalism, whatever you throw at it, it says, right, great. However critical you are, it says, good. It assembles all your criticisms, it assembles everything that's against it and just makes it part of the system. So in a way, the Deleuzean attack on capitalism has become an explanation as how it survives. And we're in a position sometimes where there's no contradictions. You know, there's no, you know, capitalism cannot do this because of this. That's a philosophical opposition. Capitalism can do anything. It just has to find a new machine to stick on. It builds itself like a machine. So Deleuze calls it a vital machine. It's like life. It's like a tree. You know, they can develop new things to deal with the problem. So it's a very disturbing picture of capitalism.